All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew. What I'm doing here at the start is we're ready to begin kind of a new section, not so much a new. We're ready to go into the last part of Jesus's ministry on earth. When we get into Matthew 21, we're going to be in the last week. We've gone through those 3 years. We're ready to enter that last week. Those last chapters all happen over a 6-day period. And once he gets in there, and so what I wanted to do, two things, especially since we were gone for a few weeks, I'd kind of bring back Matthew into our minds, and I'm going to use the parables to kind of do a little review of what we've already done, and that will set us up for what's coming in the final chapters of Matthew, because he's going to take those parables that we learned in chapter 13, and we're going to learn, I didn't bring my list today, I think it was 8 or 9 more by the time we get to Matthew 25. So we haven't even had all the parables yet, and we have to understand how they're to be used, how God intended them to use. Jesus gave them those parables at a critical juncture. And I thought it would be a good way just to review up to that point as we enter into this last week of Jesus' ministry through the light of the parables. So the first thing we have to remember is when we get into Matthew 12, there's a big change. Jesus turns away from the unbelieving generation, what he calls that wicked and adulterous generation. The leaders of the nation, and therefore the nation as a whole, has not believed him, has cast him aside, has rejected him. And now he's going to turn, at the very end of Matthew 12, he turns to his generation. The generation he created, this believing remnant, that generation. And he is going to now address them. And what he does, I suggest, is he takes all those things he taught in Matthew 1 to 12. Remember how it started? Those infallible truths. Jesus is the Messiah. You know what you're going to hear over and over? At least 2 times in Matthew 14 and on, you're going to hear the disciples and Peter confessing Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the Messiah. Those infallible proofs. Then he goes to that Sermon on the Mount, and he takes the things from the Sermon on the Mount, and he's going to now view them through these parables. And you see that in the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, the provisions, the purity of the law. When he sends out these disciples earlier in Matthew 1 to 12, he's going to bring that up again, and he's going to bring out that vain religious system that's going to persecute them. And then he goes into the rejection of his ministry by the bulk of the nation, and he's going to bring that up. Of course, that culminates in that cross. He takes the things from Matthew 1 to 12, and he's going to now bring it into the last half of Matthew, only now it's going to be viewed from the standpoint that the nation has rejected Jesus. Jesus gave the nation, when you are guiding a nation, you have to get the leaders to follow, right? So he tried to get the leaders, he offered to the leaders of Israel a bona fide offer of the kingdom. The king's here, the kingdom's at hand, receive him and get on with your program. But what did they do instead? They instead rejected the king. And now Jesus reveals something else. God wasn't caught off guard by that. God didn't have to come up with plan B because of that. God had known this all along, and he had always a part of his plan, something that he kept secret from the prophets. And that's where these parables we looked at in Luke 4 and Isaiah 61 verses 1 to 2, he talks about the preaching. This is the acceptable year with the preaching of the kingdom. And then there's just a word and, or sometimes there's a comma. And then he goes on to the power and glory of vengeance. And the prophets look at that, and it looks like it's the same event, or it's a consecutive event. And now Jesus is going to explain, no, between the acceptable day of the Lord, the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom, and the vengeance, there's going to be a time frame. There's going to be a delay in the kingdom. There's going to be a time between his first coming and his second coming, and that is where Peter and the 12 and this believing remnant is going to minister. And we can look at this on our timeline here. Here we are with the ministry of Jesus, his earthly ministry and the cross. And instead of coming immediately, there's going to be a delay in the kingdom. And that's where Peter and the 12 and the believing remnant are going to minister. So in the light of the leader's national rejection of Israel's national rejection of Jesus, that's Matthew 12, God revealed that he would need to recreate the nation through the believing remnant and give it a kingdom. Now with their rejection of Jesus, he reveals the fact, something he had kept secret before, he's not going to use the old nation. He's not going to use the nation as it was in Jesus' day. Instead, he's going to delay the kingdom so that he can recreate the nation from this believing remnant, from his own generation. And he gives them these parables to show them how they're to view all the truths he's been giving them. It's like he gave them these truths in the light that of a bona fide offer of the kingdom to Israel. They rejected it. So now he takes those truths again, puts them in this half of Matthew, and he puts in there the parables in the lens of their glasses. And that's what I was trying to show last week just by looking at some examples of this. The believing remnant is going to need to use take the teachings of the first 12 chapters of Matthew, those infallible proofs that Jesus is the Christ, the Sermon on the Mount with the purifying of the law, with the supernatural source of provisions from the Father, sending out of the 12 the nation's rejection of him, and they're supposed to view that now through the lens of the parables. And we're not going to go through this list again, but here are the parables from chapter 13. And what I've done is one to show you how these parables are to be used by the believing remnant. The first four especially already take effect in the earthly ministry of Christ. They already are taking effect. The sowing of the word of the kingdom, the wheat and the tares, we're going to look at that today. The mustard seed, something insignificant to something great, and the leaven of the Pharisees. Those are already, he's going to take those things now in the rest of Matthew, and he's going to show them how to view the things through those parables. The last four are especially out in that tribulation period. That's where they're going to come up. So last week we looked at the sower and the scribe, so we're not going to look at that again. But during this time, they needed to get their instruction and understanding from Jesus only. See, that is going to be the key. They're not to go to the vain religious system. They're not to go to the wisdom of men or the wisdom of the world. They're not to go to any place else but Jesus. Jesus is going to be the one to gain the instruction and the understanding. That's the only source. If they look any place else, it'll result in disaster. And we looked at a few of these verses with the sower and the scribe over and over, especially when you get to his death, his suffering, death, and resurrection. What does Jesus say over and over? He says, don't you understand? Do you understand? Do you understand? Do you understand? If they're going to be sowers of the word and they're going to be scribes of the word, they needed to understand the word. If they're going to preach it and record it and teach it, they needed to pay attention to Jesus. That's the key thing in these parables. So that's what we looked at last week. We looked at a bunch of examples. If you missed that, the verses here will give you those examples. The vain religious system, you see, doesn't know anything about God and his activity. Now, you see why this would be a problem for them, because from infancy, they've been brought up to say, if you want to know about God and what he's doing, you go to the religious system. Jesus comes along and says, no, don't go to the religious system, because they don't know anything about God. And he gives all those examples. Remember the example, the Sabbath. How did they treat the Sabbath? Don't do anything on the Sabbath. Prolong suffering even, prolong hunger, prolong. And that's the way God wants them to use the Sabbath. But what does Jesus come along? He said, no, they don't know anything about God and the Sabbath. God, the Sabbath, from God's perspective, the reason God gave the Sabbath was for rest and restoration, not for prolonging suffering. So feed the hungry on the poor, feed the hungry on the Sabbath, feed the poor on the Sabbath, heal the sick on the Sabbath. That's what God, see, they don't know anything about God's intentions for the Sabbath. They teach the law. They claim to be teaching the law, but they teach it without mercy. What does Jesus say back in Matthew 8 and 10 and in several other places? He says, when God applies the law, he applies it mercifully. Remember what he said? I don't want sacrifices. I don't want all that stuff you guys do. I want mercy. And what about marriage? We just read this one recently. The marriage, they look at marriage and they look as something you need to have a way to get out of. So they come with all kinds of ways a man can just get rid of his wife for any reason and satisfy the lust of his heart and marry someone else just so he gets out of thinks he's getting out of doing the external act of adultery. But Jesus comes along and says, no, you don't know anything about God's intention for the marriage. The marriage relationship is supposed to be one woman, one man, one lifetime. It's designed by God to be the basis of all human society. And they were destroying that. They don't know anything about. The point is, they don't know anything about God and what he's doing. So the point is, they weren't to go any place else for their instruction, any place else for their understanding, except Jesus. So now let's go on. We covered that one last week. Let's look at the parable of the leaven. This is a really important one. This permeates, and you'll see why I say permeate, permeates everything. Because remember, go back to that parable. Go back to chapter 13. Go back to chapter 13. Where is that parable here? The parable of the leaven, verse 33. Matthew 13, verse 33. Another parable spoke he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures. And we've already covered the details of this with the three measures of meal. But here's the phrase I want to get at is, till the whole was leavened. That is what that vain religious system, they've already done that with the people of Israel. Israel, we could call it, they've been, where I have here, be careful and watch for the leaven, this indoctrination that's permeated everything. And we'll see that as we go through some of the examples here. But let's just look and see how this beware, be on the watch. Now, why would you have to be on the watch for something? It's if you might not recognize it when it comes. You need to be watching. May not be obvious. You need to watch for it. And they needed to watch for this leaven. So go over to chapter, you'll see now for every single chapter, except chapter 17, he opens the chapter with the leaven of the vain religious system. It's one of the key things. They needed to view what's going on around through them through this parable of the leaven. Look at chapter 14. Chapter 14. At that time, we'll just begin in verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard of the fame of Jesus and said unto his servants, this is John the Baptist, he is risen from the dead. And now why was he saying this is John the Baptist risen from the dead? In order for John to be risen from the dead, what did happen to him? He was put to death. This is what we've been especially emphasizing, the vain religious system. Here we have the vain political system. And you know what's going to happen when we get in that final week of Jesus' ministry? Guess who's going to join hands? The vain religious system, the Sadducees and the scribes, are going to join hands with the Herodians, the vain political system, and they're going to conspire to kill the Lord Jesus Christ. The vain political system, the vain religious system of Israel, they're going to go hand in hand. Beware the leaven of the vain religious system, the vain political system. And we're not going to go through the whole story. My point in bringing this out is he's now in chapters 14 through 20, he's going to take those parables and show Peter and the 12 and that believing remnant what's going to go on during this time between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ as Jesus and as God recreates the nation from this little, tiny, insignificant, least of all things, believing remnant with their least of all things, a king that's been crucified. He's going to take those little, eensy-weensy, tiny, insignificant, unimportant things, and he's going to create a kingdom out of them. And they need to beware of the leaven of the vain political system, the vain religious system. Go over to chapter 15, and it opens the same way, only now we're going to be back to the vain religious system. Then came Jesus to the scribes and Pharisees, that's the vain religious system, which were of Jerusalem. So now the bigwigs are coming. He was rejected by the Pharisees out in Galilee. Now he's going, now the bigger wig Pharisees and scribes and Sadducees and all that are going to come out to from Jerusalem to Galilee. They're going to take a pretty long walk or ride and go into Galilee, and they come looking for him. And look what they're doing. They're going to try and catch him in traps. We're going to see this over and over and over again. Verse 2, why do thy disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? And then he's going to go on. We're not going to go through the whole account about washing your hands. And Jesus explains, it's not what you take in. If what you take in isn't right for the body, it's passed out again. Where corruption comes is from the heart. And what comes out of a man is what's corrupt from the heart. And we're not going to go into that whole thing. What I'm just trying to show is here we have the vain religious system trying to trap Jesus. Why aren't your disciples following the traditions of the elders? Isn't that an interesting question from the ones who are supposed to be talking about God? They don't ask, why are you transgressing the law of God or the law of Moses? Because they weren't. They want to know why they're transgressing the law of the elders, the traditions of men. And they're going to try and trap them. And of course, Jesus counteracts that completely. But this is all part of that beware of that vain religious system. Go over to chapter 16. See how this one opens. Here we have it again, chapter 16, verse 1. The Pharisees, also with the Sadducees, came and tempting, desired him that he would show them a sign from heaven. Now, he's been showing them signs for a couple years now, and they've rejected it. Now they come again. See, they're not coming sincerely for information. They're trying to trap him. They're trying to find some way they can do to get rid of him. And he says here, notice it says in verse 1, tempting him. They desired to have him show a sign. And he answered and said unto them, when it is evening, you say it'll be fair, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it'll be foul today, for the sky is red and lowering. O ye hypocrites. See, now he's revealing what they are. They're hypocrites. He's been showing them signs and they've been rejecting them. One more sign or two more signs isn't going to change anything. Oh, ye hypocrites, the vain religious system, the leaven of that vain religious system. Oh, ye hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the time. A wicked and adulterous generation seeketh after such things. And he brings that out. He describes that vain religious system, and they need to beware of its leaven. They need to beware of its leaven. And we see that as we go down here. Let's go down to verse 6. He's going to draw this out. He takes that parable of the leaven, and he's going to show them this is how you have to view the vain religious system. And he explains that in full here. Look at verse 6. Then Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have taken no bread. Which when Jesus perceived, he said unto them, O ye of little faith. And that's going to be another one. There we have the mustard seed parable, right? He's going to say in another place that if you just had the faith of a little bit of mustard seed, you move mountains. And we'll look at that as we get to that parable. Do you not understand? What do we have there? What's that, the parable? That's the parable of the sower and the scribe. They're supposed to get their understanding and their instruction from Jesus. Don't you understand? There we have the parable of the scribe. So in this one little passage, you can trace them back to all these different parables. They're to view what's going on in that day during their ministry between the first coming of Christ, the second ministry of Christ, and they're to look at it through the lens of that parable. Hey, don't you understand? The parable, that's the parable of the sower and the scribe. Neither remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up, neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up. How is it that you don't understand? That I spoke it not unto you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then look at this in verse 12. They understood. They got it. They understood that how he had bade them not beware of leaven of bread, but the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They needed to beware the leaven of the Pharisees because it's permeated every aspect of their lives. And they don't even know it. And that's what we're going to look at that in a couple minutes here. Let's just finish looking at this. Now, 17 doesn't open with that vain religious system, but it ends with it. Look at chapter 17, verse 24. Here we have, this is the tribute, the temple tax, and they're trying to catch him in a trap. They're not going to pay the temple tax, then they could arrest him and charge them as being operating against the law. Verse 24, and when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money, now this is not Caesar's people coming for their tax, this is the temple tax. Once a Jew, I think as he reached the age of 20, he was expected, all males were expected to pay the temple tax, and they're coming, and these are people, not from Caesar, these are people from the temple. So who are they working for? They're working for that vain religious system. And they come and they go to Peter. Who should they have gone to? If they were respectful, they should have gone to the master. Instead, they go to Peter. They're going to try and trip them up. They're going to try and set a trap. And Jesus is going to counteract that, and he even pulls Peter aside and reminds him, he's got to listen to him. Don't come up with anything on your own, and don't go by what the vain religious system says. Listen to me. And he gives them some instructions after that. Go to chapter 19. This will be the last one we look at with regard to the leaven. Chapter 19, verse 3. And we see it again. Over and over and over again. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him. And they're going to do the same thing again, trying to trap him. They're not coming sincerely to gain information from the true Son of God, the Son of David. They're not coming in that light. They're coming to tempt him, to trip him up, to catch him in a trap so they can get rid of him. That's why Peter needed, and the 12 and that believing remnant, they take that parable of the leaven, and that's going to permeate everything. And view what's going on around them through that. They're supposed to view the vain religious and vain political system through the lens of false teaching and leaven of the Pharisees. Now, we want to bring out the permeating aspect. That's a key thing here as we go on. They were permeated, what we might today call indoctrinated, with the leaven of the vain religious system. And here's the point. That's why with that parable, it says it permeates, it infiltrates everything. And Peter and the 12 and the believers, they don't even know it. Now you say, well, how can that be? Well, just think, probably the clearest case for me of this came decades ago, I'm sorry to say now, when I worked in one of my first jobs, I was a chemist, and we had a big company, and we had each had our own labs, but the wall between the labs was a half wall. So you had your scale areas and your chemical shelving where you put all your chemicals here and then your scale area. And so I'd be on this side, and there was another chemist on the other side. So we couldn't see through the hood section, but we could see through the shelving, and you can sit there and talk back and forth. And I was talking to this one young chemist, and he came from a Lutheran background, and he was now going to a big mega church in the area. I'm sure all you know the one I'm referring to. And he had been baptized, water baptized as an infant, and now they were telling him that wasn't good enough. He needs to be water baptized as an adult, as a believer at their church. So he's all excited about that. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity. I'm not going to put down the water thing yet, but I'm going to try and talk to him about spiritual baptism. So I'm talking through the shelving there, and I'm like, oh, water baptism, you know, that applied here, but have you ever thought about your spiritual baptism and how the Holy Spirit baptized you into Christ? And he nods his head yes, and he says, oh, yes, 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 I agree totally. And then as soon as I was done talking, he'd start talking about, guess what, water baptism. He was so indoctrinated with our vain religious systems teaching on baptism, he couldn't even understand what I was saying, that there would be a baptism that didn't have something to do with water. He was indoctrinated by that. So I tried day after day, and I tried every trick I could come up with. Well, not trick. I don't want to sound like I was trying to trick him. But every explanation I could come up with. Now, there's no water in this baptism. It's a spiritual baptism. If you come in this baptism, you're going to die of thirst. I tried everything I could think of. And he would say, yes, I agree, and then start talking about water baptism again. And I just kind of shook my head like, but you know what finally happened? Well, let me even step back a second from there. So a lot of people said to me, how could the disciples be so dense? And you look at them, you're like, how could they be so dense sometimes? They're not getting this at all. It's because they've been indoctrinated, like my coworker, by the vain religious system. You can tell them things and they nod their head yet, and they still don't understand what you're saying. They've been so indoctrinated. And week after week, I talked to him about this spiritual baptism, and he kept associating with water baptism, water, everything. But you know what happened one day? Here's the good news, and this is the good news for our disciples, too. One day, I think it was 2 or 3 months later, one day I'm like, I'm going to give this another shot. He was getting closer to the date of his water baptism at this mega church. He's getting closer to it. Now, there's a little story behind that, too, because, you know, this megachurch had a lot of, you know, low-level pastors. Well, he didn't want any of them. He wanted to be baptized by the head guy, the founder. So he had to wait a whole year to get water baptized because he wanted the main guy to baptize. So I won't critique that, but is that really the way water baptism should be carried out? He was waiting for that. So I had a bunch of months here to get through this. And 2 or 3 months later, we're working on the other side of the shelving unit, and I'm trying it again. There's no water here. This is the Spirit baptizing you into Christ. Not water, no water, dry. And he was making all kinds of racket over there while I was talking. And then all of a sudden, it was complete silence. And I saw him lean down and right through the shelving said, oh, there's no water in this. And I was just like, thank you, yes, you've got it now. It wasn't a matter of agreeing or disagreeing. He wasn't even able to understand what I was talking about. And that's what this indoctrination does to you. You don't even understand. Well, let's see that at work with Peter and the 12 here. It's infiltrated their thinking and they don't even know it. Let's look at a few examples. Of course, the primary one, the primary one here is that they were permeated with is Jesus's teaching on his suffering and death. Go over to chapter 16. And if you want three key verses for the book of Matthew, these are your three key verses. If you want to understand the book of Matthew, you have to understand these three verses, I suggest. Verse 21. Matthew 16, verse 21. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again on the third day. All right, that's the teaching. What's Peter's automatic response? Then took him and began to rebuke him, saying, "Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee." You know, what's he saying? Not under my watch. Now, what's he operating according to? He's operating according to a vain religious system, the teaching of the vain religious system. They recognized a Messiah that was coming in power and glory and was going to deliver the powerful and glorious of that day, that vain religious system, and make them the head of the kingdom. They didn't recognize a suffering and humble, a Messiah coming in a suffering and humbleness. They didn't recognize that. They didn't teach that. They taught the one coming in power and glory. Peter's operating. He's infiltrated with the doctrine of the vain religious system, and he doesn't even realize it. Jesus is going to tell him this three times, over and over and over again, and they don't get it. They're infiltrated. The leaven has infiltrated, permeated, indoctrinated them, so they don't even know what they're not getting. Like my friend, my coworker at work, he disagreed. He just wasn't even able to understand what I was saying because he was so indoctrinated by the religious system of our own day. It's the same thing back here. They've been taught by that vain religious system what the Messiah is supposed to look like. The whole nation was indoctrinated with that. And then when the real Messiah came on the scene, they didn't even recognize him. That's what indoctrination does. And Jesus is trying to teach them, and they're not able to even understand it. They've been so infiltrated, so indoctrinated with false teaching. And let's see the core problem in verse 23. But he turned and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me." Here is the key thing, this last phrase. Because why are they not able to understand him? Why are they not able to receive this truth? For thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. They're thinking like men. They're thinking in accord with that vain religious system. They're not thinking like God. And Jesus tries to teach them how to think like God. And like my coworker, sometimes they do understand. We looked at some of those examples last week. But most of the time, because they're so infiltrated with the false teaching of the vain religious system of their day, they don't even understand what he's saying. Let's look at a couple other examples. Let's look at the concept of greatness. What was the concept of greatness by the vain religious system? It's the rich and the powerful who are going to be in that kingdom, and they're going to be running the kingdom. Because if you're rich in power, you must be really God's man on earth. You must be really his special gift to humanity. Otherwise, he wouldn't be rich and powerful. Those are the ones. So when Jesus talks about the kingdom, what's the question that the disciples have? Chapter 18, verse 1. Matthew 18, verse 1. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" What that question implied, they're viewing things the way the vain religious system. They want to be the chief in the kingdom. They want to have everybody else look up to them. Well, if everybody else is looking up to you, what are you doing? You're looking down on them. They wanted subjects. They wanted people to lord it over, like the vain religious system does, walking around in their pomp and circumstance and robes and telling everybody what to do. See, they were viewing it wrong. What does Jesus do? We've been through this passage already. What does Jesus do? He takes a little child and brings him into the middle of the group and says, "You have to be like this. This little child's going to be running the kingdom. It's going to be run by the children of God, the little ones who believe in Jesus. the little ones who believe in Jesus. That's who's going to be running the show. It's not going to be the vain religious system. It's not going to be the rich and powerful. It's not going to be the great and mighty by the world standards. It's going to be God's children that come to him on the basis of faith, those who believe in Jesus. He places in that believing remnant in complete dependence on him, and they're going to be running that kingdom. That's who the greatest are. He throws away. My point here is they're infiltrated with the false teaching of the vain religious and political systems, and they don't even know it. They've been with Jesus almost 3 years here, and they still are asking questions like this. They're still infiltrated, permeated, indoctrinated with thinking like what they've been taught since they're little kids, toddlers, through that vain religious system. Let's look at another example. Forgiveness of sins. Go down chapter 18, go down to verse 21. Forgiveness of sins. Then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? Now, what might not be obvious from here is that was what at least the liberal wing of the Jewish leadership would say. They would say, count to seven times, and then you don't have to forgive him anymore. Then anger can go in your heart. Remember, he dealt with that in the Sermon on the Mount. You can have anger. As long as you don't murder him, anger's okay. You don't have to deal with that. But seven times, and that's it. And what is Jesus' response? That's the teaching of the vain religious system. Now, what does Jesus say? Jesus saith unto him, I say unto thee, until seven times, but until 70 times seven. And we saw when we were in that passage, that has two aspects. One is, first of all, it's a reference to being endless. He's not saying here, instead of count to seven, you count to 490, and then it's okay to be angry in your heart. He's not saying that in a metaphorical sense. He's saying it's endless. 70 times seven, keep it forever. And, of course, the parable that follows is going to indicate that. But, of course, there's another side. What's 70 times seven? What's 70 times 7? Does anyone know that? I mean, we all know that's 490 years, but can you reference that to anything in specific? Let's go back to our timeline. This timeline for this fifth course of punishment is what? 490 years. So I think there's probably a connection with that as well. What he's saying is throughout the remainder of this fifth course of punishment. Remember, the 70-year Babylonian captivity is over, 49 years of Medo-Persian rule that led to Gentile control is over. The 400 years of silence are over with the arrival, when God broke it, with the arrival of John the Baptist and Jesus. And now this Christ's death is imminent. Within the week, Christ is going to be put to death. Of course, one of the parables is going to teach us there's going to be a one-year extension of grace and mercy. And then what's the only thing left on that 490-year schedule? It's that seven-year tribulation period. So when he's saying that's going to be their ministry to the end of Daniel's time schedule. Continual, unlimited forgiveness of sins. And that's what they needed to realize. Peter's question seven times is what the vain religious said. That's what he'd been taught. That's the way he's thinking. Jesus is trying to teach him, no, it's limitless. And your ministry, as we're going to see probably next week now, is based on that forgiveness concept. That's what they're going to be doing all the way to the return of Christ. Let's look at another one. I think this is a great one, and especially since it's our anniversary today. My anniversary, me and Cindy, not our as a church, but me and Cindy's anniversary. Let's look at this one. It has to do with marriage. Look at chapter 19. Now let's pick it up at verse 3, because I think we really need a little bit of the background. The Pharisees come along in verse 3. And there came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And their answer to that question is basically yes. They had taken, Moses had one exception. You could divorce from your wife in the case of fornication, adultery, that kind of thing. They've taken, now by the time you get from Moses to Jesus' day, they had added so many other things, a man could dispose of his wife for basically any reason at all. They were ruining the marriage. It wasn't so much they allowed divorce. The problem was they encouraged divorce. The more exceptions they gave, the more outlet to the lusts of the man's, usually the man's heart, that would allow him to dispose of his wife. And remember, those days, it's not like women today even. In those days, when you were divorced as a woman, you really ruined your life. Could ruin your life. And they just dispose of them to fulfill the lusts of their heart so that they could pretend to not be committing the external act of adultery. And you know what Jesus says here? Jesus says, God sees all that nonsense. You're not fooling God. He still counts it as adultery, and he still counts it as lust in the heart leading to adultery. He's not fooled by all that nonsense. And look what Jesus talks about here. He talks about this, what this creation of the marriage relationship. And look what he says here, verse 4. And he answered and said unto them, have you not read? Now these are supposed to be the experts in the scripture. And he asked them, haven't you read this? And that he, have ye not read that he, which made them at the beginning, made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his mother and his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they, the twain, shall be one flesh. Wherefore, they are no longer twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. There he describes what God's intent. See, remember we talked about this earlier. The scribes, they don't know anything about God and his intent. They think the marriage relationship is something they need to provide outs for. And it's supposed to be one man, one woman, one lifetime. And it's supposed to be the basis of human society. It's supposed to be permanent. It's a gift from God. And they're spending all their energies trying to give ways men especially could escape it, could break it. See, they don't know anything about God. They don't know anything about his plans and purposes. They don't know anything about the Sabbath. They don't know anything about the law. They don't know anything about marriage. They don't know anything about God. The point is, don't listen to the vain religious system. Listen to me, Jesus. Now, here's the point why I'm bringing it up today. Look at the disciples' response. Now, what you would think, right? Here we have the disciples. They've been tutored by Jesus now almost 3 years. And you'd expect them, I'd expect them. But just remember my coworker. We'd expect them to say, wow, what a wonderful creation of that marriage relationship. We're so glad God gave that to us. What a wonderful concept. We never would have come at that on our own. That's glorious. Worship, praise God for that. Is that what they do? Look what their response is, verse 10. His disciples say unto him, here's my point. The vain religious system had indoctrinated them, had infiltrated them, had permeated into their thinking, and they don't even know it. That's why they have to beware it. Look what they say, verse 10. His disciples say unto him, if the case of the man be so with his wife, it is not good to marry. And you know, I don't want to put words in Jesus' mouth, and I know he's God, I know he reads the hearts, I know all that, but just for a minute, if he was thinking like us, you know what I would probably say? I'd say, I didn't see that one coming. Here he gives the glorious explanation of God's creation of the fundamental relationship of all human existence. And they go, well, it would be better to not get married at all than to be stuck with one woman our whole lives. See, they're permeated, they're infiltrated with the false teaching of a vain religious and political system that doesn't even recognize God's plans and purposes. Like my friend the chemist, He explains these things, and they nod. They probably are nodding the whole time. Oh, I agree. But then they come up with these questions that show they don't understand. They're not getting it. That's the danger. That's why he says over and over, beware the leaven of the vain religious system, the false teachings of that. Let's look at another one. Go to chapter 19, verse 25. Chapter 19, verse 25. Here we have with regard to the entrance of the kingdom. With the entrance of the kingdom. Verse 25. We're not going to go back to the beginning. We've covered this passage already. This is all about the rich young ruler. And they come along and they say, now the point here is, what would the vain religious system teach? The vain religious system teaches that it's the rich and powerful are going to go into that kingdom. And they bring the masters and the rabbis of that vain religious system. They come and they bring in students. And you know what students they really like? Are the rich young men. Those are ones that they can come right into their school. And they bring the students in and they teach them. And the ones that are particularly responsive, particularly responsible, they give an opportunity to do some benevolent act, like help build a synagogue or build a school for the master because they're rich. Do something. And then the master, the rabbi, will tell them that now they're qualified to enter the kingdom. That's what the rich young ruler's doing here. He's coming. He's found a master, a rabbi, and he's like, what do I have to do to inherit, what do I have to do to get into that kingdom? And we talked about the details here. And now look at the response. That's the vain religious system. Look at Peter and the 12's response here. Let's go down to verse 19. Well, let's pick it up at verse 23, because here we have Jesus' response. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, verily I say unto you, that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now Peter and the 12, what have they heard their whole life? It's the rich men that are going to get in that kingdom and run it. Otherwise they wouldn't be rich, right? Because it's a blessing from God. And they're rich, God must be blessing. They're going to be running the place. The kingdom's going to look just like the nation of that day, run by these rich, powerful men. And Jesus says, no, they're rich and powerful. It's going to be hard for them to even get in there. And look what he says in verse 24. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, what I'm trying to bring out here is not to go over, we've covered the story here. What I'm trying to show, they're infiltrated, they're indoctrinated with the teaching of the vain religious system, and they don't even know it. You can tell by the questions and the comments they have. When the disciples heard it, verse 25, they were exceedingly amazed. They thought that's what qualified you to get in the kingdom. You're rich and powerful. God must be blessing you. You must be on the right wavelength with God. Of course you're going to get in the kingdom. They were exceedingly amazed, saying, who then can be saved? And what's Jesus' answer here? But Jesus beheld them and said unto them, with men. Now, keep in mind, they should have already learned chapter 18 about where he gives the sermon on the little children and the greatest in the kingdom and all that. And this is chapter 19, and they're still not getting it. If the greatest by the earth standards can't get into the kingdom of heaven, well, who can? And Jesus, he's going to actually bring up the little children thing again, and he's going to say, it's the little children who believe in Jesus, the insignificant ones. Verse 26, but Jesus beheld them. Beheld's a strong word. Where'd that come from, Peter and the 12 and the disciples? You should know these things. But Jesus beheld them and said unto them, with men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. That's what he's been teaching all the way back at the beginning, but especially chapter 17, what did he say? In order to participate in kingdom glory, you have to be transfigured by the Father. What did he say in chapter 18? In order to participate in the kingdom, you have to be converted by the Father and taken in as his little children who believe in Jesus. Those are the ones who enter the kingdom. It's not the ones who take it by force. It's not the ones who take it by violence. It's not the ones who take it based on their own riches or power or the glory they have in the worlds. It's not the ones that are the greatest in the world. They aren't the ones that are going to be qualified. It's going to be the lowly, the my little ones who believe in Jesus. They're going to be running the kingdom. Peter and the 12 were already, since infancy have been permeated, infiltrated, indoctrinated with the teaching of that vain religious system. Is it any wonder Jesus has to say, give them a parable about it and tell them, beware. You have to be on the watch for this. You have to take heed for it. All right, let's just do, because I want to wrap this up, and we're going to go to two new parables next week, especially the new parable in Matthew 20. But let's just look at an example with the wheat and tares. Wheat and tares, and show how Jesus takes the truths that he gave in Matthew 1 to 12, brings all that over into the rest of Matthew 14 on, and he gives them the eyeglasses now in Matthew 13, those parables, the lens in which to view what's going on, what their ministry is going to be like during this time until that return of Christ, between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. We have the parable of the wheat and the tares. They needed to realize that the righteous and the wicked would coexist during this time. And you remember the wheat and the tares, right? You got the wheat growing, and then in the nights, the enemy comes along and plants the tares. Maybe it'd be a good idea just to look at that, because then maybe that'll make it clearer. Go to the parable of the wheat and the tares. That's in Matthew 13, verse 24. Matthew 13, verse 24. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the household came and said unto him, Sir, didst thou not sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? And he said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servants said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up, uproot them? And he said, no, lest you gather up the tares, you uproot the wheat as well. Here's the point, verse 30, let both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles and burn them, throw them in the fire, but gather the wheat under the barn. So there you have your parable. Now look how he uses this immediately. Go to the end of chapter 13, verse 53. He's just given these parables to the 12. They needed to realize the prophets often, when you read their prophecies, it looked like when Messiah came, there'd be an immediate differentiation from the just and the unjust. The unjust would be sent off, cast into the fire, it says here, and the just would be taken to God. That's what would happen with the Messiah comes in his glory and his power. But what's going to happen during this time when he's recreating the nation through this believing remnant, from this believing remnant? The wheat and the tares are going to intermingle. They're going to coexist. They're going to grow together. The children, and when he gives the interpretation of that, is the children of God and the kingdom are going to coexist with the children of Satan and his kingdom. And of course, when you got those two groups together, what's going to happen? Friction. Persecution. Does that remind you of anything? Remember from the Sermon on the Mount? That's one of the first things he tells them. There's going to be persecution. He's bringing those things in from earlier, and he's going to refresh their mind with them. And look how right after the parables are given in verse 53, we have an example of this wheat and tare. Verse chapter 13, verse 53, "And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed thence, and when he has come to his own country, he taught them in their synagogue." So here we are back with the religious system, the religious leaders, teachers of that day, insomuch that they were astonished and said, "Whence has this man this wisdom and these mighty works?" And then they go on to ridicule him, right? "He's just a carpenter's son. Don't listen to him. He can't possibly have this kind of knowledge." And they diminish him. From the very start, as they leave these parables, they already have an example. You're going to have those who are working against you, those who belong to the kingdom of Satan and his kingdom, counteracting Christ and his kingdom. Look how it's saying, pick it up at verse 57 for time's sake. Verse 57, "And they were offended in him, but Jesus said unto them, A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house. And he did not mighty works there because of their unbelief." They're going to be mingling with believers, are going to be coexisting with unbelievers, and it's going to result in friction, persecution. Let's look at another example. Go over to chapter 15. 15, verse 12. And here we've already covered this one with 11 example. But look at verse 15, verse 12. This is the one where they're trying to trap him. And he's not following the commands of the elders. They don't have any. They don't mention the law of Moses. They mention the laws that their elders have come up with. He calls them hypocrites, all that kind of stuff. And then look at verse 12. "Then came his disciples and said unto him, Knowest thou that the Pharisees were offended after they heard these things?" There we have the leaven again, right? They're listening, and the parable of the sower and the scribe, they're listening to the instruction of the vain religious system. See, from the very first part of the Sermon on the Mount, he told them, don't listen to the vain religious system anymore. Separate yourselves from them. Don't go by what they say. And now you're at the end of the book almost 3 years later, and they're still worried about what the vain religious system says. Don't you know you insulted them? You offended them? So we're not even bringing up that one, but I'll just point out. You see, the parables are woven through this whole section. They're getting their instruction from that vain religious system instead of from Christ. But look at what we want to point out here with the wheat and tares. Look at verse 13. "But he answered," Jesus answered and said, "Every plant which the heavenly Father hath not planted shall be rooted up." What did we read in the wheat and tares? Let them grow together until the end, and then Christ at his return will come and uproot the tares and throw them in the fire. But for now, they're going to grow together. And look what he says in verse 14. He says exactly what he said back in the parable of the wheat and the tares. He says, let them alone. They're going to coexist. They're not going to be revealed and judged until the end of that tribulation period, especially at the return of Christ. He brings that out. The wheat and tares, they needed to view everything through the idea of the wheat and tare parable. Let's look at another one, 17:12. 17:12. I'd really recommend, I'm just putting down here some, I'm just kind of skipping the stone over the surface of the water. This would be a great Bible study. I enjoyed doing this Bible study. And if you start going through chapters 14 to 20, you can just see, and you just start writing the similarities to these parables. You'll see that it's interwoven through everything, especially those first four parables. The last four parables are especially going to be applicable in that tribulation period. And the first four are particularly here already and will continue to be throughout that tribulation period. But let's look at, where was I at here? Chapter 17, verse 12. Remember, this is the transfiguration. They come down from the transfiguration, and Peter is still trying to figure out a way that Jesus won't have to go and suffer and die on the cross. So he thinks he's come up with a way. The vain religious system, parable 11, the vain religious system says that Elijah comes before Christ comes in his power and glory. We just saw Elijah up on the mount. So maybe now Christ can just come in his power and glory. And Jesus explains the role of Elijah and the rest of that. But from the sower, the wheat and the tare parable, look what he says in verse 12. "But I say unto you that Elijah is already come. They knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed, whatsoever they wanted. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them." Then the disciples understood. Parable of the sower. They understood that he spoke of them, of John the Baptist. Here we have Jesus is aligning himself with this wheat and tare. They're going to coexist. Here you have an example, John and that vain political system and the vain religious system that rejected him, and they put him to death. See, Peter, you're thinking all this wrong. Don't go back to the vain religious system and try and figure out a way for me to get around the suffering and death on the cross. Give that whole thing up, Peter. Instead, look at John. He came into persecution. He came into friction with that vain religious and political system, and he suffered and was put to death. And a pretty ignominious death too, right? Remember his death? They beheaded him and served his head on a platter at the king's banquet. And Jesus said, "I have to suffer the same way, suffering and death." He said, "Peter, stop trying to work a way around it. This I must do." It's going to be the two kingdoms intermingling, persecuting one another. Let's look at, go down to verse 22, and then we'll close with this, and then we'll pick it up at chapter 20 next week. Let's look at chapter 17, verse 22. All right, here we have Jesus's, and remember, there's all kinds of things. Let's go back up to verse 20 or 19. So they come down the mount. There's three disciples up on the mount. There's nine disciples down in the valley. And they're supposed to be doing their ministry, healing and casting out devils and doing all that stuff that they were sent out to do, preaching the gospel, all that. And what happens? They come down the mountain, and the nine come and say, "We weren't able to cast out the devil here. The devil's here, this man, the suffering, and Satan's intensification of his evil plan of evil against the disciples, Christ, and the believing remnant." And what does Jesus say? Let's pick it up here, verse 20. And Jesus said, "Why couldn't they cast out the devil?" And Jesus said, "Because of your unbelief. For verily, I say unto you, if ye had the faith as a grain of a mustard seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be possible unto you." What is that parable? Does that sound like? The parable of the mustard seed? They weren't listening to him. What parable is that? That's the parable of the sower. They were not getting their instruction from Jesus. Then he goes to the parable of the mustard seed. Watch what he goes to next, verse 21. "Howbeit this kind goeth out, but by prayer and fasting. And while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men." And he teaches them about his suffering, death, and resurrection again. But notice what he adds to this one. What does he add? He says, "I will be betrayed." Now think of the wheat and the tares. Not only is it the vain religious system out there, there is going to be a child of Satan right in his own group. It's going to infiltrate that far, the Judas. He's got a child of Satan right there in the 12, the wheat and the tares. That's how they needed to view. They needed to beware of these things. Beware of how things are going to work during their ministry between the first coming of Christ and the second. And we have, just in these few verses, we have three or four different parables brought out and explicated by Jesus.